So this panel was intended and will be a follow-up to the earlier panel that, where we discussed sort of the broad trends affecting the private equity market. All of the people on this panel have direct hands-on experience with the impact of those trends. Gene Lockhart, who is on my right, is a partner actually in two venture funds in the New York City area, where he does late-stage investing in attractive venture opportunities, and his particular focus is on financial services operations, where he has a very strong background, having earlier in his career been president of MasterCard and vice chairman of Bank of America in charge of the consumer banking. Did I get that title right?
Yeah, you had a lot of choices, but yeah, that's fine.
So he's at the end of the food chain before what he would hope would be IPOs, but has not been experiencing many of those in the last couple of years. John May on my left, who was on our previous panel, is at the other end of the food chain from an investment standpoint. He has been sort of the dean of angel investor and management of angel investor groups really since the mid-90s. He started in the Washington area some of the first really organized angel groups, which were called dinner clubs, which were funds in 99 and 2000. Has been the past chairman of the Angel Capital Association, which is the national organization of organized angel groups, and more recently has been spreading the technology and techniques and concepts of angel investing around the world, both as a in Europe and also in Asia, and most recently in December was in Beijing for the first World Angels Association meeting. Is that correct, John? So he knows it from the early stage as an investor. Gene knows it from the later stage. And then we have two panelists who are on the other side of the equation, and that is representing companies that are trying to raise money, or actually in the case of one of our panelists, and I'll say in a moment, has actually been in the process of trying to raise money for an entrepreneurial company. Ken Moradi, who is right next to me, is with the Hutchison Law Group, which is the leading venture law firm in the Research Triangle of North Carolina. That firm has a long history. He was in their Raleigh office early in his career, went to Washington at the height of the tech bubble, and was a venture attorney there, and most recently has gone back to the Hutchison Law Group and opened their first office in Virginia, which is in Blacksburg, but also covers Charlottesville. So he has experience representing early stage companies and has that. Rick Morrow, who is there, two seats over from me, is a graduate of UVA Law School who, first part of his career, was a practicing attorney in the venture law space, first in Oregon and then in Washington. Then in 1987, he left the practice of law to help start Virginia Cellular, which was a cellular carrier in the Shenandoah Valley, and was CEO of that, sold it to Altel in 2006, so he had the full entrepreneurial experience, having been a venture lawyer. And then more recently, he was CEO of a startup company in the cellular technology space and went through from the fall of 2007 to the fall of 2008 the process of trying to raise venture capital for it. So he experienced very painfully firsthand some of the conditions that we have been discussing in the earlier panel. So all of these individuals, unlike the first panel, which were a mix of academics and some practitioners who were talking about broad trends, have had the firsthand experience of what the impact of the death of the IPO, the changing private equity markets, have had on their businesses, either as lawyers, as entrepreneurs, or as investors in various parts of the food chain. So with that, I'd like to start the conversation with John May, since he's at the first part of the food chain, and ask him what he's seen over the last 2 years from an angel standpoint of this changing environment.
I'm actually here to listen to these three guys to figure this out, so I'm going to be brief, and then you already got some insights from me before, and I'd like to hear Gene's take on things. Just two quick random data points or thoughts. We operate in the niche of a niche of a niche. If you were to say that someone who could be an angel investor, someone who's using risk capital to invest a minority position in a stranger's business for high yield, that's what an angel is, not friends and family. And you'd say, well, then you probably need about $1 million of net worth being accredited. So let's say there are 3 or 4 million households in the United States that are even capable of being professional or serious about doing this as part of their investment profile. No study has ever shown there's more than 5% of those capable who ever do it. And the Jeff Soles research up in New Hampshire and some of the IRS material indicates that there's about 250,000 people who do this in the United States, which is still great in terms of comparing it to Luxembourg or Chile or Australia. It is a huge pool of capital because they are in every precinct, they're in every state. It's not 55% of the VCs in California and in Boston. You've got angels everywhere because of the nature of the wealth. But only about 5% of those who are capable ever, we think, do it. And only 5% of the 5% ever do it in a organized, professional, structured, meeting monthly, have a portfolio theory, multiple investments, 10-year horizon. So it's still an interesting phenomenon that there are maybe 1,000 venture capital transactions a year, first time in a portfolio company, not follow-on. 1,000 a year is all there is out of the institutional venture capitalists in the United States. Largest economy in the world, largest venture capital economy in the world. Only about 1,000 companies ever get to the gate with an institutional VC for that first-time investment. We think angels are more like 50, 60, 80,000. So that you have a 50 times greater chance to get in front of and get a check from a smaller amount of money from an angel than you would an institutional VC. And the trends are such that here's, now you're in our shoes, you're all my angels, we're having a meeting, we're going to invest, we're trying to decide how to screen portfolio companies. This is the net worth before the recession, and you had an allocation, part of it, for illiquid alternative angel investing. After the recession, your net worth is down here, but your alternative assets haven't changed because you probably haven't exited, so you're overweighted with your spouse and your friends and your family. You're overweighted, illiquid, and you have an allocation that you're willing to make to do what? Two things. Follow on investing in your portfolio companies that you've already invested in, and new opportunities that would be a potential home run or pre-VC kind of opportunity. Well, you've got more demand from the portfolio companies because they aren't able to exit. They have to last longer. They need more horsepower to stay alive. So your allocation of new cash is going more and more to your portfolio because you want to support entrepreneurship. They're part of your family. You've told them you're going to be there through thick and thin in a spousal relationship. So they need more money to get to the same place because of the recession. And now you have some money left over that isn't going to the current portfolio. And where is that going to come from and where are you going to allocate that? Well, you have less of it and you're concerned about the 8 to 10 to 13 years allocation. So we're still finding a lot of opportunity in what we call special situations. Susan was talking about you've got your money in treasuries or you've got your money in a CD. And maybe that's 1% yield or 0.5% yield. Wachovia pulls a line from a company about to be cash flow break even, and they'll give you 13% and 5% of the business. Instead of curing cancer, you do a special situation. All venture funds are tending to allocate A bucket, B bucket, C bucket. And C bucket is, let's no longer fund that orphan. Let's no longer look for a home run from that portfolio company. We hope they make it on their own. angels can step in and make the final investment to get to cash break even. Again, not curing cancer and not curing green technology. So it'll be interesting to talk about the state of professional money, angel money, venture money, mezzanine money, in an environment where there are so many other opportunities than the traditional 5 to 10 year wait for the IPO kind of opportunities, and how that affects you all as lawyers.
Gene, what I heard in the first session is I should feel sorry for you, but I don't. But maybe you could tell us why I shouldn't feel sorry for you, because you apparently are getting some exits, and the environment is not quite as bleak as it was painted at the first session.
Thanks. We're dealing with an incredibly complex industry right now. Can everybody hear me okay? Is this on? Okay. Little bit of background. I've been doing this now for about 10 years as a venture partner with Oak Investment Partners. Oak Investment Partners has been in business for 30 years, migrating from venture capital to what they call growth equity. I've been an LP in Oak since Oak 5, which was about 12, 14 years ago. We're now on Oak 13. We have about $10 billion of assets under management. And about two-thirds of our exits are IPOs. I also am a GP with a firm called Diamond Castle, which is a $2 billion mid-market buyout firm in New York City. Average equity check on the Oak side is about $30 to $50 million. Average equity check with leverage, ahead of leverage, with Diamond Castle is about $150 million, usually levered at about 3.5 to 4.5 times. So average enterprise or deal value, control transaction deal value would be about $500 million. If I sum up what I see in both the fundraising side of things as well as on the portfolio company and the exit side of things now, it's just plain all about quality, period. It used to be frothy. Used to be an idea a day. You'd go chase the ideas. You'd think about them. The teams were building against platforms rather than against real business models. They didn't have proof points. And then you were taking some sort of bet. And it was probably a reasonably high-risk, high-return kind of bet. The mantra in Oak forever has been triple your money in 3 years. That was the basic standard. Now it's double your money in 5. On the private equity side, the same mantra is existing. Basically, what you've got to do is define quality, not just in terms of idea or platform or proven model, but define it in cash flow terms. And you double your money in 5 to 7 years in that, hopefully being able to be in a position to delever as part of your juice in the exit. Well, let's take a look at the situation facing both forms, whether it's growth equity or private equity. You've got several factors at work here. Number one is risk-adjusted returns are down. On the private equity side, you would have seen 2 to 3 to 4 years ago, people like KKR, TPG telling you that they had a minimum IRR threshold of 25%. That's down to 14, 15, 16 at this point. On the venture side, again, the triple the money in 3 years, that's a pipe dream now. So you've seen whether it's the macroeconomic effect of lower interest rates or whether it is the desire for more conservatism, you see a lower hurdle rate. Second effect, you've got your LPs are now overweighted in alternative assets. Most pension funds, university endowments, UVA, UVimco used to have an allocation of 14% to alternative investments. If everything else has gone down, right, then you're overweighted, and that's exactly what's happened. So if you're now in a position where you're trying to raise a new fund, the first thing you're fighting isn't necessarily just risk-adjusted returns in your sector. It's the fact that other sectors have increased the overweight in the alternative sector. Third issue, uncertainty and increased regulation. Uncertainty in management teams, as in my opinion, has actually as much an effect on the IPO market as anything else. We've got several companies teed up right now on both the Oak and on the Diamond Castle side that are ready for IPO. If I get one more inbound call from Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, I'm going to cry. But the reality is neither one of the CEOs of the two companies that are perfectly teed up right now want to be public company CEOs. Why? Risk. Sarbanes-Oxley. Lifestyle. It's a really big issue management teams want the payoff, but they don't necessarily see the value in being a public company where you have quarterly earnings and you have all the control risks. It's a really, really big issue. And we can thank the unintended consequences of Sarbox for that. Fourth, leverage. Leverage is now more available than it was 2 years ago. That is not a high bar. Leverage is good for good cash flow. Thank you, bankers. You're not really helping us much, frankly, right now. You find that covenants have been tightened significantly. That's not any bad thing itself. What you're finding, though, is the specter of refinancing is now beginning to really affect what a lot of people on the growth equity and private equity side are seeing. I've forgotten the exact figure, but I think it's several trillion dollars have to be refinanced between the latter half of 2011 and the back end of 2012. For those of you studying restructuring and bankruptcy in law school, I think it's going to be a growth market for you. Because from 2012 on, for the several years after that, even for good companies, you're going to see people having a real effect of not being able to hit those covenants. So whether or not you actually enter chapter or whether or not you're negotiating extension or relaxation of covenants, it should be really, really good for people who know about and are involved in the restructuring market. Fifth would be uncertainties associated with regulation, and I don't mean just on public capital markets. I'm talking about what's the government going to choose to do next. It's a really big issue, and that affects the amount that we are willing to invest at what risk appetite. You don't know if somebody's just going to take over a business. You know, 2 years ago, one of my firms came really close to buying one of the big student loan companies. I'm so glad we chose not to do that. There are a lot of other examples where eminent domain is being claimed for certain very valuable business models, and that's a problem. I'm not making a political statement here. I'm making a statement of reality as to how investors look at it. They just don't know what's going to happen. So now you say, okay, you've elongated the life of your investments. You have a risk-adjusted return expectation, and you're overweighted an alternative asset class with your investors. What's the good news, right? Well, the good news is that corporates are flush with cash, and therefore the strategic exit has gained a lot more weight to it in our minds. And so when we think about exits, it used to be the IPO market governed. What we're finding these days is that the strategics are lining up. They're not doing deals as fast, but in many cases, their multiples that they are offering are every bit as good as the historic IPO multiples that we would have expected to see. With lower risk, they can close faster, they have less onerous terms than you would find if you're going through an S-1 filing. You don't have to have 43 pages of risk factors associated with it. And your management teams can get the liquidity event they're looking for and probably a better life with a strategic. So the good news is cash. You find that strategics are really teeing up right now. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's very helpful. And in fact, let me ask Ken, who deals at the very beginning of the food chain, whether his clients understand this changing environment and have taken it into account as they try and raise money.
They read the paper and the blogs and the so they understand that the market is down. Although I think it may be coming back this year, I get that feeling at least in the angel market. One thing that Gene mentioned that I think at least Oak admits that it moved from the VC to growth equity. I think a lot of VCs have moved that way without saying so out loud. And so a lot of my clients have spent a lot of time, and Letitia Green from Van over there, we were talking about this, spent a lot of time flying around presenting to venture funds who either don't have dry powder or who are no longer interested in funding companies pre-revenue. So they've moved upstream, and some of the data that John May mentioned earlier from the Center for Venture Research indicates that angels have moved upstream a little bit too, and they're sort of forced to. And in the trenches, what that means is angels realize they may have to fund you a lot further along than they used to. And so they're funding you more at an earlier valuation point, which means you're getting a lot more money, if you can find it, at a lower valuation, so you have to give up more equity on the front end. Another thing that happens is the angels are getting more creative with the ways they finance the companies that they are interested in. And our firm has seen two deals where the angels actually did a basically a straight debt deal, which was unusual to me before recently. And it was kind of a factoring deal where the company wasn't big enough to get some kind of receivables financing, but the angels saw it as a great opportunity and did it with a very, very high interest rate. Some other creative things that have gone on are angels sometimes used to fund companies with convertible notes so they wouldn't take the risk of really mispricing a deal. These notes used to be pretty simple. We'll loan you this money. If you get venture financing, we'll convert at that rate plus a discount, 15 or 25% to whatever the venture capitalists pay. Now that they know this stream may go up for a long time, these notes have become a little more complicated. Sometimes you'll see graduated discount rates for the longer you stay in place. And sometimes they realize you may have to make do with the money you got from them. And if you're successful, they haven't converted at a good valuation that indicates how early they came on board. So they'll have some kinds of cap on their conversion rate. Another thing that we're seeing from the corporate law perspective in the early stages, in the past, it was really simple, the choice between a corporation and an LLC for a scalable business like the kinds that we work with, because the VCs are going to want to invest in a corporation. So you're pretty clearly going to have to convert to a corp later on, so we might as well keep it simple from the beginning. Nowadays, the path isn't that clear. So a lot of companies are looking long and hard at staying an LLC or forming as an LLC because they're more flexible and there are some tax advantages in the beginning. And so those are some of the changes we're seeing.
So obviously the people are being affected at all levels by this changing private equity market for the startup to IPO. And on that note, let me ask Rick Morrow, who had the experience of contacting and trying to raise money from a large number of venture funds at probably the worst time in the market, what he learned from that experience and how familiar this all sounds from the other side.
Thanks, Dick. I'm a little worried about this discussion about the food chain and where I might have fit into that discussion. So just my own view is that the theme for this should probably be back to the future. Having started in about 88 with my first business with an American Express card in a basement and migrating that to raising about $40 million, paying it all back, all through bank lending, no venture money, no equity besides the credit card, and kind of see that flow into the growth of the VC world, high returns, and all of a sudden the VC world starts to become the asset class of choice for high returns. And with that, a lot of money, a lot of competition for deals, very high valuations as a result to that competition, and so actually very attractive, I think, for startup companies to get that VC money because the valuations were so high, and if you're one of those that made it, great, and if you didn't, you had a really good run. And so now we come into my second or third life, shifting into trying to do a venture-backed deal, partly because the cost of the project we had was very high in terms of software development, so we had to get a big, large amount of money up front as opposed to organically growing slowly with customer after customer. We had to have a big hit in order to get the momentum to actually launch this business. And in that period when we had the crash, and it'd be interesting to think back, what would have happened had we not had the subprime disaster? Where would we be today? Would the venture guys still be running, or would we have hit some sort of cliff due to some other inconsistency or imperfection in the market? But with that crash, what we found was an immediate, almost instantaneous, and I guess it's a wonderful thing about the capitalist system, when there's some sort of cataclysmic event, it knows how to react and it reacts quickly. And that reaction was basically all the VCs that I had dealings with who were in the early stage or seed stage shut down literally overnight. And they shut down because they saw no liquidity coming in after them on the B and C rounds, and so not wanting to be stuck having to fund or not have the funds to continue to keep those companies going, they held on to their cash, held on to their dry powder as a way to come in if they needed to, not knowing how long the dry spell would last. And certainly it's continued to see a little bit of percolating life, but they're still very concerned about that. So when that happened, all of a sudden, no returns, no IPOs, few strategic deals, and so the whole system has, in my opinion, just kind of froze up. So where will that lead? I think that what's interesting is Jack Biddle, who most of you know, talks about smaller deals, later stage deals, earlier exits. Now, that to me says lower returns. If you add all those things together, you're going to have lower returns. It's going to make the asset class less interesting, unless you have fewer venture firms. And so I was talking to Ashton Newhall, who's got his dad started NEA, and Ashton's got a company called Montague Newhall, which is a fund of funds. And Ashton yesterday told me that he thought there'll be 25 to 50% less VC funds in the next 3 to 4 years. 25 to 50% less. So what does that mean? Well, that means less competition for deals. And less competition for deals means higher or lower valuations, and lower valuations means higher returns. So I think we're just in a cycle. We're back to the future in that I think startups are going to have to be organically grown from angel groups, credit cards, hopefully get to a point where they can get some commercial lending or a strategic partner who will put some money in for a strategic reason. And that will take place over the next 5-6 years. And then there'll be VCs, but they'll be hitting the really good high prospect companies with less competition, lower valuations. And so I just see that we're in a cycle, and we're in a cycle that doesn't bode well for the vast majority of startups. They're going to have to do it organically and just work their way through like everyone used to do in the old days.
Let me go back to Gene for a moment, because Rick raised a very interesting point, which really hadn't come up in the previous panel, which is this shrinkage in the venture capital industry. The statistics that I have heard is that there were 1,200 members of the National Venture Capital Association in 2000. Last week I heard that that's now down to 800, and I've heard projections it might go as low as 400. Clearly, massive consolidation. The numbers of funds under actual total dollars under management have been shrinking, as have been the VC investments. So Rick points out that this trend would impact entrepreneurs in that they would have lower valuations, less choices for funding. Gene, do you see from your vantage point in New York that the VC community is shrinking, and how is that impacting your investment opportunities?
I'm still shocked to see Rick Morrow in a tie, but anyway. Oak 9 was $1 billion. Oak 10 was $1.4 billion. Oak 11 was $1.7 billion. Oak 12 was $2.3 billion. And Oak 13 is $700 million.
I think that tells a numerical story.
Now,
what are the dates of 11, 12, and 13?
Roughly one every 18 months. The $700 million was an interesting decision. It's fully subscribed, but it's an interesting decision. And that is, we sort of have made a decision that if you think about a $2.3 billion fund, Oak 12, and you think about the deployment rate and then the investment rate and then the return rate, you know, you've got to be writing per partner roughly 3 to 4 deals of $50 million plus per year for the investment period. Those kind of things just aren't around right now. Why? Because the strategics, remember I mentioned the strategics a while ago? The strategics are taking them out of the market. So what we found was that retreating back to a $700 million, and maybe it's 200 too low, I'm not sure, but we're gonna reduce our average in equity check back to the size it was pre-1999. And what we're still going to try to do, however, is focus on those companies that understand a quality platform and cash. So it doesn't mean we're going to go back into the Series A or Series B. We're going to focus on C and D rounds, but it's going to be smaller equity checks with teams that have a better understanding of what it really means to build a business, hence the term quality. I really think our risk-adjusted returns may go all funds, all investments, all funds for Oak over 30 years, the IRR has been 38.7%. We're now targeting for Oak 13 to be around 22.5%.
And Gene, how about the food chain in terms of, did you used to get your deals from people who had done the B and C and then you came in afterwards? And I've heard a lot recently that the B and C, Series B, Series C, the middle size VCs are really hurting and therefore hurting this flow because then you don't have the coattails.
That's a very good point. The A and B folks have not been able to get a new fund raised. They're not going to be able to re-up, and the company has got growth equity needs, whether that's organic or by acquisition because they see value depression and they want to acquire, or they see a market opportunity they want to grow, and it needs capital. So we come in right at that point. About 70% of our deals are non-auction, proprietary deals, and that gets down to Rolodex, and that gets down to networking and just staying in touch with people. And we don't do financing, whether it's open market or staple financing. We just don't do that.
John, maybe you would comment on what Gene has just described and the impact it will be on angel investors, because the typical model has been that you assume there will be an A and B round of venture financing that will effectively both value the company, if you use convertible notes, but also take out, in some cases, the angels and give them an early exit.
Well, I mean, everything that panelists have talked about is the current market. I mean, what we're finding is that if you can make 13% plus warrants with some of your liquid reserves, why would you then take a risk of pricing an equity deal that takes a VC later and worry about trying to make 13% in a risky environment if you can basically have a collateralized factoring and make 13% because the banks aren't lending? So as long as the banks don't lend, then there's an opportunity for non-bank finance. As long as the VCs don't provide B and C rounds, why should an angel take the risk of an A and fall off the pier instead of the bridge? So that's what we're all talking about, is it's a very unusual and a very fluid time, because you basically, if you have funds to put in illiquid, and a lot of, I mean, there was an estimate, I think, at the end of 07 to 08 or 08 to 09, there was a reduction of 23% of the number of millionaires in the United States. Because of the markets, and they've come back, but there is less cash available for your entrepreneurial clients. So that's why, for example, the LLC instead of the C, if you're not going to find a VC that requires a Delaware C Corp, why in the hell not keep the losses early and flow through the dividends later to the non-institutional angel and other kind of investors, super angels and corporations, because they aren't as sensitive to an IPO C Corp. They'll go ahead and take the losses early and take the cash flow dividending out later, which was unheard of in our business of sophisticated angels. We thought we had to be like VCs. And then the other idea of the convertible debt, what we found is that the most important thing with these convertible debts is not so much the discounts to the future rounds, which are turning out not to exist anymore, but to have the default valuation upon the entrepreneur failing to raise any money and deciding on a different sort of tool for the miners instead of a home run for the IPO. We'd much rather have a default price and then have you liquidate with imagine a $2 million pre-money valuation that never gets a $5 or $10 million infusion, but creates a product that's worth $10 or $20 million. Last year, the fourth quarter, the average IT M&A transaction was $26 million after having $18 million go in it. So it might very well be that what we want is to have the default, therefore own at $1.5 million pre-money instead of the 5 or 10 that the entrepreneur thought they would have with the VC, sell it to the strategic at $10 or $20 million and make 10 times our money without ever having this alternative institutional funding risk and cram downs that is all the fear of the early stage investors in light of the VCs needing to get out.
And I'll say it also affects the kind of companies that are getting angel funding, at least from the deals that I'm doing. It's companies like software companies that can make a dollar go a lot further and actually get a company off the ground with a lot less money. It's real simple to see the exit, even if they're not going to be a Google, like a platform company. If they're just going to be a tool, the angels will fund that because they know they're not going to get crammed down. They know they're not going to face a severe capital risk if they can't raise more money later. And also, a lot of companies who can get grant funding, who have a product they can sell to the DOD, for example, the angels will fund those and leverage that extra non-dilutive money that comes in the door, and that's sort of changed the kinds of companies that we're seeing get funded.
Now, key thing in first round outside money raising is the two things in the business plan of your clients that are vital to us. How much follow-on financing do you predict before you get to cash flow break even or exit? And what's the estimated terminal value of the company after all rounds of dilutive financing? That is everything when it comes to your ability to convince a group of angels or a super angel or a family office to invest, because if we don't see a clear path to get them to cash flow break even and exit, and if we can't work with you on what's the terminal value so we know how much we're going to be diluted, so we know how much we own at exit, you might as well not prepare the business plan and not do the financing, because the early investors will back out and not want to write the check if there's a fear of follow-on financing or of a coincidence of appreciation and value of the entrepreneur with exit. Is if a $20 million exit is okay for the entrepreneur as opposed to a $200 million exit for the entrepreneur, imagine how that affects our ability to get in and get out. And if we have dependence on follow-on rounds of growth capital, it may or may not be there after the Dodd bill, after the double dip recession, after the world affects us. It's just really inhibiting those kinds of companies.
The other thing that is a major effect, and I was so glad to hear you say, talk about the cash flow break even. A lot of financing, future financings in the past have been based upon the assumption that when you're in that growth mode, before you need another round of financing, that you'd have access to revolvers from commercial banks or from hedge funds or somebody else. The reality is those revolvers are at will, and banks close them with no notice many times, even for good companies. So say you've got, say you're a CEO, you've gone through your B round, you've got a proven platform, you see some opportunities, you've been in order with your account the whole time. Guess what happens when banks are deleveraging? They will cancel those revolvers, and they don't owe you an answer. The other thing to be very mindful of is that the more banks that delever, and the more that the reality of mark-to-market asset accounting really hits their balance sheets, the less traditional bank support will be around. That's going to have a knock-on effect. The knock-on effect is going to be at every stage of the life cycle. Whether it is in the early stages and assuming that you'll get some financing, or asset-backed financing or revolver financing, you just can't make that assumption. And that takes you back to lowering of risk thresholds, and it takes you back to lowering of returns.
Yeah, just as an aside, there are angel groups out there who are beginning to think that they should form a sidecar or a separate funding mechanism of their angels to get away from this idea that angels only do equity. And if companies are having a hard time, that means throwing more equity and then having the argument about valuation. If what they really need is debt, shouldn't the angels then form a debt pool for their portfolio companies to tap into on the asset-backed or on the factoring, and basically take money from a family office or an angel from their bucket of liquidity and income, as opposed to their long-term illiquid alternative asset bucket, and try to tap into both by having a vehicle that's for debt financing the portfolio, as well as a vehicle for equity for the portfolio? Because if you have a mindset that's only equity, you will consistently cram down your entrepreneurs, making it harder for them to stay enthusiastic, because we're throwing more and more equity at them when we really should be doing some equity and some debt from these non-traditional sources.
And if you think about the rates of return, where you're willing to provide asset-backed financing, you know, you in many businesses now you're seeing a reduction of advance rates from 75 down to 50% advance rates. And you're seeing that the pricing of that asset-backed deals have gone up due to scarcity of capital willing to do it. So you're looking at a LIBOR plus 800, LIBOR plus 1,000 on that order. You know, you're locking in as a used-to-be equity-only investor, you're locking in a really nice flow of return. And with a 50% advance rate, that means that those assets, of course, could go down substantially in realizable value, and you still have your return locked in. So that what you're putting your finger on is a very good point.
What you're hearing is that all along the financing mechanism for entrepreneurial companies, it's getting more difficult. The private equity environment is more difficult, starting with the IPOs. The traditional lending environment is getting more difficult because of the banks consolidating and deleveraging and not providing as much funding. You also are hearing the seeds of sort of a new financing system emerging with different types of institutions, with the cash coming out. And one of the questions is going to be how the entrepreneurial community is going to respond to this, because they have a model in their mind. We're teaching entrepreneurship around the university. There is a model that has developed over the last 20 years, and what you're hearing is that that model is about to change fairly radically because of these forces. And one of the questions I have is to what extent the entrepreneurial community is prepared for this change. And so I know Rick has lots of contacts in the entrepreneurial community, not only having done it himself, but being involved with the Young Presidents Organization, which deals with entrepreneurs. I'm curious, Rick, do you see people cognizant of this change?
Well, and to John's point, I think the next big opportunity is really going to be in some form of kind of mezzanine, private mezzanine financing. We used to have it all the time in the telecom business, where you probably EBITDA positive, but weren't strong enough to get traditional bank financing because you weren't asset based. You didn't have any assets; you just had cash flow. And private groups would come in and do a mezzanine layer, and to basically take you to the point where you could get traditional financing or didn't need the financing. And I think that's just an area that if you're an entrepreneur and you've got money and you're building a business and you've got a period of time that you're going to need cash and the traditional banks are not going to be there for you. And I've had revolvers pulled from me in 2000 when the banks just decided telecom wasn't fun anymore. And but if you need that money, you're going to take a mezzanine, even if it's significantly above prime, because you're going to view it as a short-term stopgap. And if the lender thinks that he's secured enough and has the a feeling that he can bet on you and has enough feels that he's going to in some way be able to recoup that and be paid back, he can extract a pretty decent price. And usually the way they soften that is maybe it's a year with interest only. So to the entrepreneur, you're taking a gamble. You may be giving away a lot from a interest standpoint, but if you're only paying the interest and you think it's going to get you to that level where you're going to get traditional financing or get beyond a financing need, you're going to do it, especially with the VCs contracting. I think with the traditional sources of money contracting, there's going to be a big opportunity for anyone coming in. It's a middle.
Sources of equity or debt that you can tap into that weren't out there before? Have we started to see the beginnings of any new little industry clusters or finance firms or overseas funders or family offices? Or?
A little of both. Not so much overseas, because I think they're dealing with their own issues. But I have seen a number of people who traditionally might have put money into smaller venture funds, non-institutional, who are also looking, those groups are looking at forming their own kind of mezzanine or lending, kind of like the convertible note, except don't even worry about the conversion and just do interest only and just make sure that you're kind of at the top of the heap when it comes to where you are on a secure basis.
Ken? This is, many of the people in our audience are aspiring lawyers. They're here because they're interested in the private equity section. And so as we begin to run out of time, you might comment on how all these changes that we're seeing, how you see it affecting the practice of law in the private equity area, and what advice you might have to aspiring members of the bar in your area of practice.
Well, like people told my friends and classmates who are thinking about pro bono work, don't do company-side startup work unless you really love it. And that was true even when I started, which was 97. Because in the big law firms, I don't know if everybody knows what realization rates are yet, but you will learn. While your realization rates are very low, and your collection rates are very low, your friends in the debt department will be sky high, and they'll be stars. It'll be easy path to partnership for them. And as well, you have two-thirds of our client base turns over every year because they go out of business or get acquired. So you're constantly having to get new clients in the door, which makes for a more difficult time. And our clients are a lot more sensitive to bills, so you spend a lot more time talking with your clients and figuring out ways to save money on their bills. So unless you really love working with startups, which I happen to do, I would not advise getting on the company side. Now, working with the investors or upstream at the private equity level, that's still a fun place to be, but that would be my advice.
Excuse me, Dick. The only place you're going to get really fair and balanced advice is from a lawyer or a firm that you have developed a relationship with over a long period of time. Because in my sector, which is that growth equity to private equity side of things, you can talk to bankers, and bankers are going to replay to you what you've already said. Consultants will do the same thing. What it's hard to find is a firm and a person that is well-versed in everything from raising money to further financing to chapter and restructuring and alternative vehicles of financing. It's rare that you find that, but if I'm a budding 2L or 3L, I'm going to be thinking really long and hard about how I can build a portfolio of capability across all of those spectrums over my next 5 to 6 years with a large firm. I'm going to try my best to understand the various financing needs, because we've talked here about leverage, we talked about early stage, later stage, exits, and restructuring. You really have to know all of those to be valuable, and I'm going to make sure I get assigned to partners who will teach me that.
You've just learned the path to success as you all wait out your stipends to go to work, and so we'll probably break at this point to give Robert sufficient time to give us what we thought was the keynote is now the endnote address of the session. But I know it's very interesting because I had a chance to talk to him a little bit last night, and he has some insights into what's going on in the IPO market and how that impact is beyond just the cyclical impact we talked about in the first panel. And Gene mentioned the impact of Sarbanes-Oxley, fact that high-quality companies don't want to be in public markets because of all the pressures on CEOs. So we'll hear a little bit about that, but also I think there's some other findings that you had in your research. So why don't we break the panel at this point, and as soon as he's ready, I guess we start again. Chris?